The following workshop, 200% of Nothing, What Are Research Studies Really Telling Us, will be presented by Dr. Alexander Schaus. And now, Dr. Schaus.
I wanted to show you just another example here. I brought so many examples. I mean, this is so much fun just to show you all this research and the problems that a lot of these studies create in terms of misleading clinicians. Here's a good example. As you know, there's been a lot of research on side stream smoke. And there's been inferences made that many of the children born with low for birth weight, usually at under 4,500 grams at term, are children that had mothers who smoked. And this is one of the primary reasons why secondary smoke is being considered a problem in the workplace. And these are some of the studies that actually provided some real solid science behind what the mechanism is. That's the bottom half, and some of the stronger prospective epidemiological studies that supported the argument that cigarette smoke is a hazard for the infant and increases the probability and the reasons why that probability would increase for them. And just to show you something real interesting, when these children of very low birth weight grow older, some very interesting things are seen developmentally in these children. Again, using psychometric instruments, this is a developmental test of visual motor integration. You see here some models of cards that are shown to children that get progressively more complex as they get older. And what you see here is full-term children and very low birth weight children. And you can see that the full-term children have far less difficulty in drawing these particular shapes and symbols as they get older than children who began with a very low birth weight. And we believe that with the number of children that are also heroically being saved in medical centers of very low birth weight, many of these children do enter the school systems, and many of them are handicapped by learning disabilities. And this contributes to why there are more and more schools being set up for children with special handicaps of this nature, and why we're losing so much fund from our general expenditures of general education under Public Law 192.42, which requires that every school district in the country provide services for handicapped children. There's 25 categories of handicap, and learning disabilities includes that group. So, the reason why I think this is so important to show you is I was giving this lecture some years ago in Oregon to a state educational conference, and in the audience was a professor from the University of Minnesota. And he said, Alex, you know, there's another alternative hypothesis as to why so many of these children, because the active agent, which as you just saw in the previous study here in active pediatric Scandinavia, that explained the mechanism of why the children were low for birth weight, had to do with thiocyanates and their action. And he said, you know, there is one type of alcohol that's rich in thiocyanates. And we didn't believe it. We did a whole bunch of studies at the University of Minnesota. And I asked him if he had published. He said, oh, yeah, we published it quite some time ago. And you see here a 1982 paper in Alcohol Clinical Experimental Research showing that cyanates beer, and only in beer, in no other source of alcohol do they find the thiocyanates. Now, when you start thinking about the number of people in this country that consume beer but that also smoke cigarettes, do you see that's the interesting thing about it? And because most people that smoke tend to eat foods and drink beverages that are acidifying by nature. Because the more acid you become, the quicker you get rid of nicotine in the system. You see, so you don't have a tendency to watch people who smoke eat the right kinds of foods. I mean, they drink coffee, which is acidifying. They eat beef, which is acidifying. They eat wheat products, which are acidifying. They'll have sugar, which is acidifying. And if you look at all, and they will have beer, which is acidifying. So each of these items produces an acid ash state, which facilitates the excretion of nicotine. So the question he's posing, before we jump to the conclusion that side stream smoke is the probable cause of much of the children being born low for birth weight, maybe we should also take a look at this. Now, the value of just knowing this research is if you can think of the high school parties and the college campuses and the fact that at many of these parties, sex occurs, women get pregnant at these parties, right? They don't use protection. They impregnate the individual that they're having sex with. And here they're partying, and they will continue to party possibly at that time and constantly building up those thiocyanate levels unexpectedly, because there's no evidence of risk or hazard been associated So anyway, he sent me more studies, but just to show you one, I thought this might be of some interest to you. And you can also see up there some sites from the British Medical Journal, and etc. Another area, God, that I love constantly coming up, we talk about confounders, is the whole area of osteoporosis. Now, there's an area that's loaded with confounders. First of all, just so we understand a little bit about bones, and most of you are pretty familiar with, 30% is organic, 70% is inorganic, and most of the inorganic complex is hydroxyapatite. And it's very poorly absorbed if you were to give it, unless it's in a microcrystalline form. And you also need a ratio of calcium to phosphorus for better absorption, and certain trace elements are extremely important. I'll go into these in some detail here in a moment, just to show you how that then affects studies that have been done. If you assess the risk of osteoporosis, there's a beautiful book that was done by Dr. Farndon, and it was published by Macmillan in 1985, called Osteoporosis. And what I did is I took the whole book and I summarized in two columns the high risk and the low risk factors for osteoporosis. And so when people are told to have orange juice with calcium in it to lower the risk of osteoporosis, I mean, who are we really talking about? Who are we directing that information to? Is it black people? Is it Caucasians? Is it the rich Caucasians, poor Caucasians? Caucasians that eat a lot of protein, a little bit of protein, that exercise regularly, that never exercise, that are overweight, that are underweight, and et cetera, in addition to all the medical histories that are associated with increased or decreased risk. So that's one of the things. And I thought this list is really helpful, and just maybe to point out that from a trace nutrient standpoint, inadequate magnesium, manganese, zinc, copper, and phosphorus are all items that increase the risk of osteoporosis, not just calcium. And one of the reasons why the consensus conference that dealt with osteoporosis that NIH put together was terribly misleading, I think there was a great influence by the dairy industry at that meeting, because dairy products are low in magnesium. And if you really would tell the public the full story of all the nutrients that are required to reduce the risk of osteoporosis, you would have to talk about magnesium and phosphorus and other trace minerals, of which milk is not a great dietary source. But if you want to talk about one source that's rich in one nutrient that's involved in osteoporosis, then that would be calcium, and then the dairy industry would be very happy. See, this is where you're mixing politics with science again, and it has a tendency to mislead people. So if you look actually at what do these trace nutrients do, the calcium-phosphorus ratio are the primary bone minerals, of course. Then you've got chromium, which reduces urine calcium loss. See, that's very important, looking at net effects of things in the body that would retain calcium levels. Copper is necessary for building bones and bone strength and flexibility. The hydroxyapatite is essential for the protein in the calcium matrix of the bone. The magnesium is needed for calcium absorption in the bone. The silica needed for the mucopolysaccharides in the bone. The vitamin C for building the bone protein. The vitamin D for calcium absorption again, which of course most people are aware of, hence the reason why we enrich, as they say, milk with vitamin D, and usually D2. Zinc is needed for the enzyme alkaline phosphatase, and boron in magnesium deficient females increases the retention of estrogen and testosterone. And by the way, the form of estrogen is 17-beta-estriodol. That's the one that it spares, and that's a very valuable thing to spare. So it's almost that boron at about 3 to 4 milligrams in women who have been on low magnesium diets has an estrogen sparing effect. And so this is almost a natural way of providing some estrogen therapy for postmenopausal women, just by adding boron levels. In women who generally have a low magnesium diet, the USDA data from North Dakota, Dr. Nielsen's work, who was at this conference last year, I think he was in the Minneapolis conference, was about 0.25 milligrams per day. So you see, the women who most need that extra boron are the ones who are getting way too low a quantity of it. But there's other factors, too. And just to show you again, it's not just about these trace elements. There's other things, too. Look at this. Now you've got the factors that increase calcium absorption, increase metabolic needs, which include growth, pregnancy, lactation, calcium deficiency in exercise, increased vitamin D levels, and acid media in the intestine. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment, because that's somewhat important. That has to do with low gastric activity, because calcium is better absorbed in a more acid base. The higher you raise the pH, the poorer the absorption becomes. Lactose, when there is normal lactase activity, fat increases gastrointestinal transport time, the acidic amino acids, and ingestion with a meal. The factors that decrease calcium absorption include lactose in the presence of lactase deficiency, a vitamin D deficiency, diets rich in oxalic acid such as spinach and rhubarb, which forms insoluble calcium oxalates, phytic acid, which is the outer husks of most cereal grains, forms insoluble calcium phytate, fiber, again, the alkaline media, which does not help, increased intestinal motility, so it moves too quickly through the system, mental and physical stress, medications such as glucocorticoids, anticonvulsants, aging because of decreased absorption, and excessive phosphate in the diet. Just drinking too many sodas, for example, taking too rich a intake of phosphoric acid, a very common source in our culture for phosphates. Low gastric activity. If you'll notice on a classic list of what kinds of diseases and conditions are associated with low gastric function, we're talking primarily here of achlorhydria and hypochlorhydria, and also sometimes linked with that low levels of pepsin, you will find rheumatoid arthritis on that list. You'll see osteoarthritis on this list. And there's that osteoarthritis. And so you see, you could be dealing with someone at 25 and say, look, take your Tums with calcium, or eat your orange juice with calcium, or take your calcium supplements from oyster shells, from calcium carbonate, which is poorly absorbed compared to the citrates. And somehow the person, based on that information, will have the faith that in 20, 30 years, they have significantly reduced their risk by taking these steps, and it may not have made any difference at all. Show you another thing in the behavioral area. This comes out of a book that I wrote in 1991 with Simon Schuster called Eating for AIDS, that deals with pediatric nutrition and exercise. It's based on a study of over 600,000 children in the New York City public school system, where the largest gain in academic test performance on standardized test scores was observed. They used the California Achievement Test over a four-year study using a design called an interrupted time series design. And what we did in the book is we isolated 12 nutrients, 7 vitamins and 5 minerals, that both from a theoretical and mechanistic standpoint, as well as from the actual diets that were given to children, were the probable or culpable nutrients that raised the academic performance standards of the children. And part of what it did, it increased fluid intelligence, which is just, it improved the neuronal capacity of the brain to benefit from the information that was taught by teachers. And this did a lot of other very nice things to the students in terms of increasing their capacity to learn. And that was reflected by over a 15% gain in academic test performance over 4 years, bringing an entire school system, which is the biggest in the United States, from well below the national average to above the national average, without more teachers and without changes in textbooks or higher salaries. And already the schools at the time that the study started, they had 17.5 students per teacher. And it was actually the exact same number at the end of the study 4 years later. So even the whole issue of crowding of the classroom wasn't a factor. There were over 200 other variables looked at, and nutrition seemed to be the key variable that accounts for these changes. A lot of this work was done by Dr. Steven Schoenfelder, who has been also at this meeting to present some of his data a few years ago, and all of his work has been published. So what we did with the chief nutritionist, New York City Public School, and myself, we worked on a computer to isolate what those nutrients are. I want to bring this up because it just shows you the kinds of deficiencies, both behaviorally and in terms of learning, for each of the vitamins we identified, and I have a second overhead for the minerals. And the reason why this is important is because it helps us to understand some of the early controversy that existed about the role of nutrition, and especially mega-supplementation, in the ameliorization of children with behavior and learning problems. And we'll be taking a look at a 1977 study that went through just horrible controversy at the time, very, very unjustifiably. And this is Dr. Alan Cott's work. Dr. Cott has passed away. Now, on page 26 of his book, he made the following statement, quote, "The application of orthomolecular principles can be successful in helping many learning disabled children. Positive results have been obtained when the treatment regime consisted of the following vitamins." Now, this is his protocol that he used with children. And what you have here is niacinamide or niacin, 1 to 2 grams daily, depending on body weight. 1 to 2 grams of vitamin C, 200 to 300 milligrams daily of pyridoxine, 200 to 400 milligrams daily of calcium pentaphenate, and the B-complex 50, which is roughly the 50 milligram or microgram combination, B-complexes, a half a tablet, or about 25 milligrams of each of the B vitamins, or 25 micrograms that they apply, like in the case of folic acid. The vitamins are generally administered twice a day, so the split dosage. The magnesium is frequently used for its calming effect on hyperactivity and to prevent the depletion of this important mineral by the large doses of pyridoxine. So that's in the book. No serious side effects have resulted in any of the thousands of children treated with these substances. So that's the anecdotal claim from the clinician. And I had a chance to visit him in New York. He shared everything, anything that I wanted to look at in terms of data. I was very impressed. I did say to him, you know, it's unfortunate that no university has taken this and challenged this in some kind of clinical trial. You don't need to do it with thousands of children. You can take 12 children and just see if we can get some results. Very easy when you're doing supplements to set up placebo designs. And so here is Alan's, and he also published this. It was appeared in a journal, Academic Therapy, in 1977. He also wrote a monograph on it, and he provided this information to researchers. Now, the reason I bring this up, and I want to show you one other thing, that you also, before you do a study, you do a literature search. And if you look at some of the literature, you'll see things like, this is just some examples, two or three of them, and it's a rich literature out there. Coleman's study in biological psychiatry says B6 is beneficial only if the serotonin levels are low. Brennan's work in the Journal of Learning Disabilities, B1 and B6 megadoses together can make children with attention deficit disorder hyperkinesis worse. So this is what you do as you prepare your design. You say, oh, this is interesting. We need to consider this. And as you develop your human experimentation design, you want to make sure you're inclusive of all of that kind of literature so that you don't get yourself in any kind of trouble creating side effects in children that maybe might even suggest you shouldn't do the study, or at least that you're aware of how those side effects might potentially develop. So what was really interesting is in 1984, Dr. Haslam at the University of Alberta in Calgary at the School of Medicine, I believe he's a pediatrician, decided to do a study to challenge Alan Cott's work, because what was happening is more and more clinicians were trying his anecdotal evidence, his clinical experience, and saying, by God, this works. This helps these kids. And it reached such a point that so many clinicians were using it around the country and claiming it was helping children that someone finally decided to challenge it. And how do you usually challenge a study? Well, the best way is to do a double-blind placebo-controlled trial. And what happened here was that, and I just want to show this to you without going into all the depths of the study, but if you'll notice how they designed the study, it literally predicted that the children would get worse. And that what would start to happen is children would drop out of the trial for the simple reason that the side effects, you know, would just force the parents to ask the researchers to pull their children out of the trial. Look here at the pyridoxine levels. You start at baseline. The first 2 weeks, they just give them nothing. In weeks 3 and 4, you see the pyridoxine level now 200. And remember, there's no added magnesium here. Remember those early warnings? There's no magnesium. And it was right there. They read it. They could not have created the protocol, even knowing that Alan Cott existed, had they not read what he did. Because you can see part of the nutrients he uses in his protocol are being used in the study. And those that he wisely learned from clinical experience, you should add, to minimize any side effects, they excluded. And the reason why I wanted to point this out to you is because when this was published in the journal Pediatrics, it was published nationwide, worldwide, as an example of the dangers of giving children mega-supplementation. And that no parent, no clinician, and certainly no licensed doctor, should ever give children high dosages of vitamins above the RDA, unless they were, you know, monitored very carefully. And they talked all about kidney tests and liver tests and et cetera. And they claimed they showed the children were experiencing hepatotoxicity and had no evidence of the hepatotoxicity in the paper. But they made all of these statements. But you could imagine when a child is now at weeks 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14 at 500, 600 milligrams of pyridoxine with no added magnesium, no added zinc, just the side effects that were going to be produced in some of those children. But you see how this was designed in such a way that if you wanted to show that mega supplementation can be harmful, this was a beautiful way of doing it. And still claiming that you're not doing anything very different than the doctor who made the claims that thousands of children benefited. So what they're saying is the doctor's lying. He's covering up all of these side effects that he should have reported, but wasn't. Well, nobody was. You know, there wasn't a single parent in the state of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut who ever filed a complaint against Alan Cott saying the kid got worse, that they wanted a refund. There was never a single complaint. And if there was, and based on the number of cases that Alan had, he should have had 825 parents that should have been up in arms because their kids, and not one, based on the number of total kids that were exposed to this protocol. Do you remember some of the work with the Feingold diet? Remember Ben Feingold at the University of California, San Francisco? That's another example of a guy who just went through hell as they started doing these studies which claimed to replicate his work, but they never replicated his work. They set him up in such a way that it would, you know, why even waste the money? You could have written up the protocol, written up the results of the paper, never conducted the study, and it wouldn't matter if you did the study or not. It would have come out the same way, because the way it was designed. Dr. Keith Connors, who was at the time at the University of Wisconsin, the Department of Psychology, worked with the Pediatric and Psychology Department on the study. It's, again, a double-blind placebo-controlled trial published in the British Journal. It was published originally in Pediatrics also, and later on was critiqued about 4 years later in the British Journal of Clinical Psychology by Dr. Vicky Ripier at the London Institute of Psychiatry. And she just tore this paper apart. But by that time, the research that critiqued and criticized Ben Feingold had become inculcated into the literature. And every conference of dietitians and nutritionists and pediatricians, they would bring these speakers to those meetings talking about the dangers of Ben Feingold's diet based on these double-blind placebo-controlled trials. For example, in the study at Wisconsin, they used active placebos while implying they were alert. And what made them active? They were cookies. Made of, you know, you've made, I'm sure some of you have cooked a cookie or know from reading the contents label on a box what goes into a cookie. Now, you can't tell me a cookie is inert. Not a chocolate cookie. Not a chocolate cookie with milk in it also, and with sugar in it, and with other ingredients in there. Just think about this. This is their placebo. In fact, I pointed out that in Spear's study at the University of Kansas, on 1,000 subjects ages 2 to 15, and this is in the literature, in the allergy literature from 1970, the most common food allergen that Spear found was chocolate. Okay? And the reason why I picked the Kansas study, because it's in the Midwest. It's a little bit closer to the kinds of regional variations in food habits that you see around the United States. They claim the challenge trials were based on a misleading estimate of an average intake of 26 milligrams. This was totally inadequate. In fact, what they used is one-third the amount that the children who reacted in Feingold's study would be exposed to on a minimum. So if you were, for example, to look at 150 children, you would see that usually children who are reacting to these food additives were reacting about 70, 80 milligrams or above. So what did they do? They exposed the children to one-third that amount. You see, this is a classic example of the kind of stuff that I was trying to tell students in medical schools. I love doing this to students. This is a real fun one. I created a study that looks like it came right out of the New England Journal of Medicine. And I designed it. I ran the whole study. Of course, I didn't. But the way it was done, it was an NIH study, I told them. It involved over 1 million subjects. It was done in 10 different facilities in the country, so it's a multi-center trial. It was double-blind placebo-controlled crossover everywhere in the country. I had the best researchers in the world, like Harvard, Yale, Stanford, you know, UCSF, and the students would look at this, and of course the study says that aspirin does not have any therapeutic benefits for people suffering from headaches or migraines, and did not have any anti-inflammatory effects or any effect in reducing pain. Now, what do we buy aspirins for, right? For headaches and for... So what, are we all getting placebo responses here from using aspirin? The students look through this and they're going, God, I must not have been around the week of June 23rd, 1991 when this was published, because you would figure this is a front page story. It takes them a little while, because it's a little game I teach them, that sometimes you can actually get bogus studies in the mail. I've had it happen over the years, where people send me reprints. I assume they came from the journal that's cited on the reprint, and it didn't exist. The study didn't exist. For the first case I had was like this was in 1972, when a guy sent me a study, and at that time I was in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I was finishing my master's degree, and I went over to the medical school because I was going to take the references at the end of the paper and pull the papers and look those over because I just couldn't believe what I was reading. Well, I forgot the papers, so I went all the way back home for it. And before I did that, I said, well, you know, I kind of remember roughly what issue, what year that, and what journal it was in. So I went looking for it, and I got so frustrated. You know how you're in the library there, and you pull one after the other, and you look through the index, and the subject's not there, the author's not there. You know, could I have been that awful? Maybe the year before, the year after, and I'm so frustrated. So I said, heck with it. I'll go home, get the paper, 20-block walk, come all the way back to the school. Now I got the reprint in my hands, got the page number and everything. I said, God, that's the journals I looked through. So I pull it open, and there's an ad on that page. You know, and I'm saying, oh, wait a minute here. So anyway, to make a long story short, this guy had a little history of doing these things, creating papers that never got published. And you can well imagine how they start getting cited. So for me, because it happened a few more times in my life, I thought it might be good for me to do this to students, and let's see how long it took them to figure out what's wrong with the study. And so actually one of the students, it took them 3 weeks, went into the library, which is across the hall from the class where I was teaching, went in there, pulled the New England Journal of Medicine, discovered that there was some paper on kidney dialysis in there, the exact same pages, and said, he says, doctor, you got a problem here. This is a non-existent paper. He says, good for you. You get an A on that one. And then I said, what's wrong with the paper? And at that point, everybody's reading it and said, well, by God, it's evident. The dosage, one-third, one-quarter of an aspirin tablet was used in the study. One-quarter. No wonder you got no therapeutic results. You see what I'm saying? It's about just manipulating the dosage. You can change the subjects around, too. There's so many things you can do. So just the fact that it's double-blind placebo control can be very misleading. And this is why the public has so learned to rely on this word, double-blind placebo control, as if that's going to provide us definitive answers. And many times it can mislead us for generations unless somebody corrects it. The other thing, the doses were relatively long intervals, which is not a valid model for real-life conditions of exposure. What we mean there is the children snack. They don't just eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. They are exposed to foods, and especially more junk foods during the day. And that's where some of the chemical additives are found. So what you want to do is you kind of want to expose them so that their body doesn't have time to have these little washout periods in which you may not have observed any effect. So real-world conditions are very, very important. Use of cytotoxic tests for allergy is irrelevant to testing the Feingold hypothesis. Now, this was so funny. They said they gave all these kids a cytotoxic test, and they found none of them were allergic. Well, you know, if you know a little bit about cytotoxic tests, you know you don't use a cytotoxic test to test for a chemical in the food and whether you react to it. Connor's main outcome measures are potentially insensitive to the true effects. No ratings were done on a daily basis. And Connor's consistently minimized, discounted findings which supported Feingold's hypothesis. In other words, when he published his paper, he didn't give credit to any of the papers that supported Feingold's work. He went right into the papers that criticized his work. And the only question I would have had, and we always need to be very aware of this, if you see a paper that just starts off right away with, you know, 19 people have said this is wrong, so I've decided to do the 20th study to show that as well, you've got to be a little suspicious. It's the question of, why are you doing the study? Now, if there were 5 people that said it worked and 5 people said it didn't work, well, it would make some sense to explain what you felt was wrong in those 10 studies and to try to show how you can improve upon them to resolve the controversy. But when the whole weight of evidence, according to you, says that this man's hypothesis hasn't been supported by anyone, you've got to begin to wonder, why would you have to do another study then? And especially when there exists a literature out there that would have provided some balance. But these are the kinds of things that everybody was facing. And when people send in letters to the editor, it's very, very sad. So what does Connors finally conclude in this study? He summarizes by saying, quote, many withdrew from the study because of gastrointestinal complaints, indicating that megadoses of these vitamins are potentially toxic and can cause severe hepatic injury. Because of their ineffectiveness and possible serious side effects, megavitamins should not be utilized in the management of children with attention deficit disorder. And the reason it's there, you see this quote, it's got to upset people who are familiar with the fact and who have actually seen it work, because this is what you will read in textbooks today. This is the information that's taught in the Department of Dietetics. This is what the instructor explains to the next RD that's going to be graduating in a year or two, is the reason why anybody selling vitamins is not only pulling a scam, in their opinion, but also potentially hurting victims out there, you see? And so they come out of school thinking that they're on a mission, you know, to protect us all from unscrupulous clinicians and manufacturers. This is where this battle line is drawn. And doesn't this benefit who? The food manufacturers, who utilize these nutrients and can count on these kinds of studies to vindicate their use of these products, which could have neurotoxic effects. No, I don't think it's a conspiracy. I really don't. I think what you're seeing is just very prudent business decisions being made. It's not a conspiracy. It's people sitting in a boardroom saying, what are we going to do about this? There's some evidence here. I'll give you a classic example. The first clue that tartrazine, which is yellow dye number 4, might have adverse effects in children, it didn't come from human studies. It came from a fruit fly study. It's very interesting. A fellow that had been on the scientific advisory board of a large American food corporation told me the story. What happened is in the fruit flies, they discovered that when these little bugs were exposed to tartrazine in the food that they consumed, nothing happened until one day a researcher turned on the fluorescent lights in the laboratory, and before the end of the day, many of the fruit flies were dead. And they they've been doing a study for a little while, and they just didn't understand what was going on. So as fate would have it, the study was repeated at one time without the fluorescent lights on, and none of the fruit flies died. So somebody, you know, wisely eventually said, I wonder if it's the lighting. This makes no sense. And to make a long story short, they found an interaction between the ultraviolet radiation spectra from the fluorescent light and the tartrazine. And now somebody said, now wait a minute, school children across this country are exposed to the tartrazine we sell as a food additive, and they sit under fluorescent lights. I wonder if that's making children hyperactive. There you see it, sitting in the boardroom saying, what do we do now? Do we stop sales based on a fruit fly study? Or do we commission people that are friendly to our industry, that we can trust in case we've got a problem here, so that our public relations people can work it out before it's released? So we can get out of the business if necessary without losing, you know, so we can deal with liability issues? You know, well, I'm just talking about business decisions. You can call that a conspiracy if you want.
But you have those business decisions being made by the funny food.
All over the place. All over the world. Yes, sir.
I think we should use this to record it.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I'm Carl Lauren. I think you're much too charitable. And I can afford to be very different. I'm a writer, and people won't read my stuff if I say it the way you say it.
Mm.
And that's really my question. You are raising startling information in a kind of an academic mode. I could take any one of the statements that you've made and make a giant headline out of it and put red ink on it. And now, if I could get people to read it, I could change the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I want to do. So I guess several questions. When lots of people make these same kinds of decisions, I think it's fair to call it a conspiracy. But that's a political statement, you see?
If you can show that they are colluding.
They don't have to collude in a conscious sense.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I'm saying that
if it's the ethics of their industry.
That's right.
Yes, right.
That's right. We have a moral tone here.
Right.
An evil moral tone, right. Which seems to permeate a group
right.
of people.
Right.
And we have on the other side researchers who don't do much about it, and we have a media that doesn't publicize it, and we have doctors who are afraid to come out of the closet.
Right.
I mean, we have an awful lot of this going
right.
on.
Right.
And I've come here this meeting because I'd like to learn some stuff that I can write about,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to stir the pot.
Mm-hmm. Carl, one of the things that's so interesting is the question of how do these... You were here this morning
yes.
when I talked. you see some of these headlines, you know, oatmeal does not lower cholesterol. Makes all the front pages of newspapers. Immediately has an impact on consumer buying habits. They're saying, oh, it doesn't matter what I eat now, you know. Here they were saying fiber helps me. And remember, those studies, they learned the hard way. They were buried somewhere. They might have appeared on page 26 of the National Enquirer. They might have appeared in section C6 of the local newspaper. Those were not front page stories, as the evidence was unfolding that eating more and more fiber would reduce cholesterol for those who had high cholesterol. That story did not have a sensational impact of somebody saying, gee whiz, after all these studies came out, here's a study that says this isn't true. That's the story. The real question is, how come it made the front page? And it's that process that's very important to understand, of how they package the story. They prepackage the story, and they make sure aggressively those who would benefit from it know about those. So, for example, if a pharmaceutical company that is selling products that lower cholesterol at an enormous expense to the consumer, okay? Along comes a study that says, gee whiz, man, we can get 30 million of our people that aren't using our product because they're eating that oat bran and it isn't working, and here's the study that they ought to know about, which really says to us that maybe we don't have significant scientific agreement here that fiber will lower cholesterol levels in hypercholesteremic individuals, particularly males. So we better make sure that the public knows about it. And you know, if you work in that field of journalism, of how aggressively you can promote that story by helping to write it, which takes care of the job of having to research the paper and getting the quotes from the authors at the universities and making sure they know how to reach those authors and etc. You can just lay it out, and that's frequently what actually happens. Is when I call up the New York Times and I say, how in heaven's name, after I just read this research, and I just read your newspaper, and I read it 2 days ago, and I've talked to half a dozen colleagues who have totally dismissed this paper. How come you put that on the front page the way it says it? Because that's not what the story says at all. In fact, let me read to you, page 36 is a direct contradiction to what your headline says. And look at the precautions that were taken by the authors, all the qualifiers here in their research. You didn't mention anything. You made it sound as if the whole world should be convinced now by this one single study that we've all been wrong. Where did you ever get your information? And the answer is usually, well, I'll tell you the guy that sent it to me. Why don't you talk to him? So in other words, they didn't write the story. They took a whole prepackaged story that was put together by a PR firm, and it made the front page, and it sells newspapers. Because you know what happens in the office environment? Somebody says, gee, did you read this? Look at what it says here. That sells. But the fact that later on, six eminent researchers, some with Nobel laureates, will say, this is nonsense, that just doesn't make page one anymore.
It makes page one for the audience that is looking for it.
This is the end of the recording on Side A.
I think the public has reached the point now, personally, from traveling constantly throughout the United States in more of my political capacity, they're sick and tired of it. They've become very mistrustful, and I think they'd love to believe that their intuition is right about how they're being jerked around by journalists. If you look at the Food and Drug Administration, they have 42 information specialists, and their job is to cultivate a relationship with Associated Press, Knight Rider, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, Miami Herald, you know, to work those newspapers, to convince them that anything that comes out of our agency you can trust. This is good information. And they can play games like, if you don't use the information, when there is a story, you may not get it from me. You might be the last newspaper in your region to be able to get the news that you need to give your consumers. They'll be reading it, they'll be listening to it on the Walter Cronkite show, where Dan Rather might be reporting it, and they'll say, how come I'm not reading this in my hometown newspaper? So there's a lot of ways to subtly suggest that it'd be nice if you publish what we give you. So, yeah, it's the politics that's...
So you need to write a book.
I've read six of them. I got a seventh one ready. You're right. I am a little bit too academic. I am a little bit too kind. To show you something else, the intelligence nutrition. This is an interesting story. It goes back to the New York City study with those 600,000 students. Just to show you, when New York City tried to change its diet and institute simple things like no food would have more than 11% sugar, because all the evidence suggested that sugar had no nutrients and contributed to low nutritional density diet. And what they wanted to do is raise the vitamin and mineral levels, and why not do it with foods that were rich in nutrients? And so what they decided in New York City was set up specifications for manufacturers to provide cereals and other food sources that were low in sugar. All the manufacturers said to the New York City school system, we can't do it. So what they would do, for example, they'd come to the chancellor of the New York City public school system, it's the equivalent like superintendent of schools for most school districts, and would bring the ugliest looking cookie you've ever seen in your life that will actually literally fall apart and say, this is the kind of cookie that this food specification will create. What child in America would ever eat a cookie like that? And the chief nutritionist would say, are you kidding me? You can make a wonderful cookie with 2-3% sugar in it. It's got a nice shape, doesn't fall apart. You know, you see, or another example, they wanted meat that had no more than 9% fat. And most of the beef in this country that was sold to the school systems was between 21-23% fat. So she went to Chicago, where they've got a lot of beef, and they've got 1.2 million children that eat breakfast and lunch in New York City. That's only second to the United States Army in terms of purchasing food. The $100 million food budget per year at that time. This is 1979. And she says, will you cut the fat out? And they said, we're not going to start doing that. So she went to the butchers around New York City and said, look, we'll ship the meat here, you cut it out, you make it a little bit of extra money. It made a lot of butchers very rich. Kids got their low-fat diet. See, when the cereal people said, look, man, there's not a single processed cereal in this country that's 11% sugar. They were averaging around 50%. But you wouldn't notice from reading the box, because you see there's 72 different ways to describe sugar. So they would put it as the third, fifth, seventh, and ninth ingredient rather than the first. So you get a box like with Raisin Bran. You would think it's primarily cornflakes and raisins. But it was actually, because I did this in the lab in 1977, I was taking the nutritional biochemistry class. So we're checking, you know, different carbohydrates and proteins and titrating vitamin C. We had it on a midterm. We had to check out what the carbohydrate content, what types of carbohydrates was in a box of cereal. We were given Raisin Bran. And I came up with 49.5% of the box was cereal, was sugar, pure sugar, just sucrose. I couldn't believe it. I said, well, I messed that up for sure. You know, I'm standing outside in the class with the other students and saying, what did you get? And they were talking 51%, 48%. Well, our professor didn't even believe it. So he gave us all X's on that because he didn't believe it. So when we looked at it, we challenged him. We said, look, we can't all be wrong. So he reproduced. He said, I don't believe this. He says, it came out to be 49.1% of the box of sugar. But you wouldn't know that from eating the box. From eating the cereal. You could have probably eaten the box and done better. But anyway, what happened is the New York City school system, because of their purchasing power, convinced the cereal manufacturers to make special line of cereal. And they made it just for New York City. And they found the children loved the cereal. It increased the purchasing. They bought so many more 100,000 boxes of cereal that year and every year thereafter. And pretty soon that's the reason why in the supermarkets and across this country you started seeing low-sugar products, because they'd actually done this for the New York City public school system. New York City was responsible for many products, because they took out most of the synthetic dyes, almost all the artificial flavors, most of the preservatives such as the butylene and hydroxytoluene, and you saw the BHT, BHA products. They removed those from foods to ensure that children had fresh foods, rich in nutritional density. And the outcome of that was unexpected, dramatic gains in academic test performance. That is a great story. In a nation that's struggling to compete in the international workforce, to say, look, we're all pointing fingers at our teachers. We're talking about guns and drugs and alcohol and this and that. Maybe there's a reason why our children aren't doing as well, because their brains aren't being fed. And look at this study, which didn't make the front page of any newspaper. It got buried in a journal. It was reported. I was there at the panel meeting. I was the chair of the panel at the American College of Nutrition. When the researchers from California came there, three of them, professors, to describe the 65-page paper. And I remember at the end of this one-and-a-half-hour presentation, I looked at this audience of about 200 MDs, PhDs, and I asked this question. Okay, you've just heard it. You've had the paper for a day. You've heard the researchers. What's wrong with this paper? Let's get into it. Let's tear these guys up. It wasn't a single hand. And after a while, I said, now, come on. This is a very critical group. I mean, you're the cream de la cream of nutrition scientists in this country. What's wrong with their study? They're telling you that when they lower the amount of sugar, raise the nutritional density, children's academic performance goes up at levels that have never been seen in history in the schools, among 50,000 school districts. Plus, they report that in 111 school districts, they've seen the same, using the same protocol. And what do you think happened? Finally, a guy got up and he says, "This is an amazing study. Do you understand the implications of this? Do you understand what this study says? Everybody should be eating and feeding their children in this country. Do you have any idea," he said this, "do you have any idea what this would cost the food manufacturers in this country if this story came out?" I was hoping there was a reporter back there, you know, would just run out to the newspaper and say, "Have I got a story for you?" But it never happened. Jay? Here's the mic.
I'm sorry. I talk about that study a lot in my lectures to the public, and one of the most statistically significant facts that I got out of that is that in addition to the 15.7% gain in academic performance, there was a drop of 70,000 learning disordered children.
Right.
It dropped by more than 70,000 kids. And so I go around to school systems and say, "How would you like to get rid of 70,000 learning disabled students out of this?" And when I first got the information from you or Steve Schoenthaler,
1986, I think.
Right. He said, we can't let this paper go yet because CBS, I thought, had bought the rights for it. And I asked him about it every year. I said, "Can I talk about this?" And he finally said, "Well, they're not going to do anything about it. Go ahead and start talking."
Yeah. What happened is QED, which is a journal program in England, broadcast it. And you know what the net effect was the next day? There wasn't a single vitamin found in the whole country on a shelf. It's the first time a product had totally ever sold out in the country's history. And they doubled manufacturing capacity, and they were importing vitamins as fast as they can get them on ships and barges into England, and they could not meet consumer demand. Because in their study, rather than do it with food, they just tried a simple dietary supplement approach, and it worked. That is the reason why. That's a beautiful lead-in, by the way, Jay. Thanks for that. For this overhead, because in this study, what they did is they looked at the whole issue of what happened in New York and did it raise the children's intelligence, which was one of the hypotheses. And they worked with Dr. David Benton, a psychologist, on the study. Now, here's the interesting way the British government dealt with this: to suggest that a supplement, even at RDA levels, of vitamins and minerals would improve intelligence would be to admit that children in your country were suffering from malnutrition, right? Now that's something where, from a political standpoint, if you're Margaret Thatcher, you've got some explaining to do. Why are there hundreds of thousands, not millions, of children that are malnourished in a country like England with its wealth, where the Queen was, what, receiving $23 million a year as a salary or something? I mean, there's going to be some questions in Parliament. And so you can imagine the reaction of the food industry, the nutritionists, the physicians, and everybody. So how did they defend themselves? They said, we'll prepare a report. Well, the report came out by the Ministry of Health there. And the results, there was no evidence of malnutrition in England. Now, I looked at that report very carefully, and I said, because I'd been at Oxford three times to lecture. And I remember back in 1983, I learned something that just shocked me. If you look at the recommended daily allowances in the United States, published by the National Academy of Sciences, you'll see a list of vitamins and minerals for which there are RDAs. Do you know how many there are in England, RDAs? Five. Four vitamins and one mineral, iron. And every one of those RDAs is much lower than any other country: Soviet Union, Germany, England, France, America, wherever you look, Japan. For example, the RDA of vitamin C in England is 30 milligrams. So in other words, as long as most people get at least 30 milligrams, there's no evidence that people are getting insufficiency of vitamin C. Do you see the games they play? But what about magnesium and manganese and all of those other nutrients and all those other vitamins? Since there is no RDA for it, there's no way to establish that there's an insufficiency of it, so you can't say that people are malnourished. These games that people play. The analogy I create here, which I think has helped lay audiences, is if in the United States we were trying to measure fitness, and we want to see how fit this nation was, wouldn't it be marvelous if we set a standard for those of you who are overweight and slow, if we made it 20 minutes for the mile, which most of you could easily walk? So if we found that most Americans could meet that standard, we could say as a nation that we're fit. But you know that's not true, right? That's a game we'd be playing. Most people wouldn't let the government get away with it. But when it comes to more complicated things like 1.3 milligrams of vitamin B1 and etc., it's too technical for the public. They don't understand, you know, whether they're malnourished or not. And so when the researchers contend that we've got a serious problem, that offends people by the millions, then we have a situation that's awfully serious and affects a lot of people's lives and their futures as well. What this nation would be like if in 4 years we'd institute those kinds of food specifications in the 50,000 school districts as a national policy through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, through some action in Congress, you see, just to improve the food supply, how strong our nation would be in 5 or 10 years, of the students who would have learned so much more, that would have created, improved their creative capacity, which would have created innovation in this country, which put us right into that competitive profile that we need to do. By the way, it's just in Japan. And Japanese researchers in the departments of education, they're observing exactly what we have hypothesized here. As in school districts now, where they're starting to get exposed to more and more of American food, the children's behavior and academic performance is declining. And because they're aware of this research, they're actually seeing it happen. They can measure it. So when I was there just recently in Tokyo, a huge group of people in the field of police work, social work, psychology, education, medicine, pediatrics, there to learn as much as they could about how to avoid these American foods. Now, I know that doesn't go well with all the McDonald's that are there, the Skippers, the Pizza Huts, the Coca-Colas, the Pepsi-Colas, and all these products that are sold there. But my advice to them was stick to the Japanese diet as closely as you can. Because if you decide to adopt the American diet just to be like us Americans, I guarantee you, we're going to whip you. And boy, that sure made them a little nervous there when they started hearing it. So hopefully that motivated them to take some of these things into consideration. I want to show you, just for a moment, since this is a workshop, something you might find kind of interesting. There, if you look at the July 13th, 1994, Journal of the American Medical Association, that's July 13th, 1994, that is a wonderful issue. The whole issue is dedicated to this issue of research and statistics in medicine. The whole issue, from cover to cover. Marvelous papers in there. Some of the things I just want to pull out of there just to whet your appetite to show you are inculcated in many of the articles written by people who, by the way, are very critical of the medical literature, and rightfully so, as you've seen. For example, inter-rater agreement for individual items on pretest clinical relevance instruments. What they're showing here is, what do typical peer reviewers do or should be doing before they pass a paper for publication? I'll show you some examples. They should ask, were the therapeutic outcomes measured in the study important? Were the subjects of the study representative of patients who would actually use the drug? Did the control group represent a clinically meaningful comparison group? Was the treatment effect clinically meaningful? Were side effects adequately measured? Was approval from an institutional review board explicitly reported? Was the study ethical? Yeah. These are just examples of the kinds of things they're asked to do. Here's a... if you're going to go into review articles, this is a wonderful way, kind of a nice shortcut at times to... Everybody's very busy to say, look, here's a subject I'm interested in. Let me see if there's a review paper out there that might help us.
Just enough for you after your talk.
Thanks very much. Are the results of the study valid? Primary guides. Did the overview address a focused clinical question? Were the criteria used to select articles for inclusion appropriate? Some secondary guidelines is it unlikely that important relevant studies were missed? Was the validity of the included studies reproducible? Were the results similar from study to study? What are the results? What are the overall results of the review? How precise were the results? Will the results help me in caring for my patients? Can the results be applied to my patient care? Were all clinically important outcomes considered? Are the benefits worth the harms and costs? So if you find, and this is why it's lovely to have that particular issue, and you know, you can always buy one of those issues. You don't have to subscribe to the journal. Because this is very valuable in the future as you're trying to make clinical decisions for your patients to know what are the elements that you need to be looking at to see if you've got a competent review paper. Some of you are familiar with the paper I wrote in 1991 on germanium, because all of the literature earlier had suggested that germanium was basically very safe. And then I uncovered 18 deaths associated with the use of germanium products, and to some degree concluded, although there wasn't a solid amount of evidence to support it, because of lack of autopsies and analytical procedures, but we found that in 12 of the 18 cases, what caused death was contamination with a germanium dioxide, which is a toxic substance. So they were using a very cheap industrial grade form of germanium and combining it with the germanium siliceous oxide, and it caused renal failure and death in 18 people. Extremely important that the public and clinicians are aware of this. People wrote stories in the mid-1980s when this was introduced in the United States, never mentioning once that these deaths were in the literature. And as a result, as a clinician, assuming that others had reviewed the literature, that the products were safe, you gave it to patients. Many people here at this conference did that. And it's extremely important to look, you know, in the literature very thoroughly, because it wasn't difficult to find these cases. You didn't have to translate from Japanese into English to do that.
I've got to make one quick statement.
Yeah,
I wrote a book on germanium.
Did you?
And in that, back in those years, and I predicted in my book, I knew about germanium oxide as being toxic. I predicted that someone under the pay of the FDA would deliberately introduce germanium oxide, cause some deaths, to drive siliceous oxide off the market.
Well, actually, the first death was 1981. Second one, there were two in 1982. This was well before it ever arrived in the United States.
Yes.
So the deaths, you know, were attributable. Just, and I was just recently in Japan and actually met some manufacturers who told me which companies were responsible for doing it. And the Japanese were very upset about it because, you see, on the heels of the Showa Denko situation with the contaminated L-tryptophan, had a death occurred in the United States with germanium, it might have been possible that basically a ban on all products manufactured in Japan coming to the United States. And that could have cost the Japanese literally hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars.
So, it's trivia, but there was only one licensed manufacturer in all of Japan for making germanium, and I visited that factory, Tokai Sengo.
Right.
And the others were bootlegging it in from Taiwan and mixing it with oxide.
Right. Good point. Some other things, inter-rater agreement of individual items on pre-test to methodologic quality instruments. What was the study design? Were both inclusion and exclusion criteria specified? Were subjects representative of target populations? Were control subjects appropriate? Was enough information provided to determine whether sample size was sufficient? Was the power declared a priori? If blinding of investigators to intervention was possible, was it done? If blinding of subjects to intervention was possible, was it done? Was measurement bias accounted for by methods other than blinding observers or subjects? Were statistical analyses appropriate? Were attrition of subjects and reason for attrition recorded? For those subjects who completed a study, were results completely reported? Were known confounders accounted for by design or by analysis? Were the drugs for which conclusions were drawn actually tested in the study? Were the populations for which conclusions were drawn represented by the subjects in the study? Did the statistical analyses used in the study support the conclusions? So you can see, these are just some of the questions that you, as a reviewer, in looking at these papers, need to look over. Experimental unrandomized, you look at those. Non-experimental, like the cohorts, the prospective and retrospective, the cross-sectional case controls, case reports, case series, or none of the above. It might be a single case. What was the study question? Is it clear what the question of the study is? And then a nice little checklist that can be used where you just say yes, no, or partial, not applicable. Was the study question sufficiently described? Was the study design appropriate to answer the study questions? Were the inclusion and exclusion criteria specified? For case studies only, were patient characteristics adequately reported? Were subjects appropriate to the study question? Were control subjects appropriate? Were subjects randomly selected for the target population? If subjects were randomly selected, was the method of random selection sufficiently well described? If the subjects were randomly allocated to treatment groups, was the method of random allocation sufficiently described? If blinding of investigators to intervention was possible, was it reported? If blinding of the subjects to intervention was possible, was it reported? And finally, these last 10 items, was measurement bias accounted for by methods other than blinding? Were known confounders accounted for by study design? Was there a sample size justification before the study? Were post hoc power calculations of confidence intervals reported for statistically non-significant results? Were statistical analyses appropriate? Were the statistical tests stated? Were exact p-values of confidence intervals reported for each test? Were attrition of subjects and reasons for attrition recorded? For those subjects who completed the study, were results completely reported? Do the findings support the conclusions? You get kind of the sense that if actually each study were to go through this rather carefully, and the answers to these questions were resolved in the paper itself, I bet you we'd get rid of 90% of what's published today. 90% of what's out there today would not be published. And I would think that would be at least 90% of a literature that is misguiding us as clinicians. I think one of the extraordinary stories that I remember some time ago was dealing with hair analysis, which has been one of those analytical techniques that to this day people have suffered from. One of the things that happened is a fellow who didn't like, he's notorious as an anti-supplementationist, went ahead and decided to take a subject or to cut their hair, made no concerns for the proximal distal parts of the hair, the parts closest to the scalp, furthest from the scalp, and cut it all up, sort of homogenized it with his fingers, apparently. Then put it into separate little envelopes and sent them to different laboratories, got the results back and showed that the results were just crazy. They were scattered. So there was no reliability. And that appeared in a prominent medical journal. Well, what happened at the State University of New York, a researcher decided to take a look at that study and use it as an example of awful research that gets published in respected medical journals. And the students got involved in the study, the graduate students in research, and they took over 30 subjects, and they took only the inch closest, about 2.5 millimeters of hair, that was all proximal in the nape area, clearly defined suboccipital area of the head, carefully made sure that they had stainless steel scissors, made sure they had proper types of envelopes to store it in, compiled adequate amount of information about each patient, sent that to a number of laboratories, a dozen of them, and then found remarkable interlaboratory reliability, at oftentimes where the correlational coefficient for the trace elements was 0.99, which you don't usually see in research. That's extremely strong evidence of the value of doing that test in terms of reliability. And do you think that paper, even though it was submitted back to the same journal, got published? No. Do you think a letter to the editor saying, we have conducted this study and we've published this in another journal, it might be valuable for your readers to be aware that we have discredited an earlier work which was based on a preposterous research design, was ever published in that journal? No. And if you're looking for that paper, it's hard to find. But you see, this is the kind of problems that are created in research, so that when you come under attack and your medical board now throws this really awful paper down as an example of your using a technique which has been discredited and published in a very respected medical journal, unless you're aware of where that literature is, you're at a real handicap. And of course, the people that can help you if they're aware of the research are the laboratories, for example, when that occurs. So if you were doing work, say, we use one commercial lab as an example, Doctor's Data. If you went to them in Chicago and you said, you know, what's the story here? They would say, oh my gosh, if that's what's happened to you, let us FedEx a whole bunch of studies to you which discredit that earlier paper. And then you could go back to your medical board and say, well, look, this initial paper was nonsense. The whole design biased the outcomes. And that's the way you can fight, you know, some of this bad research that appears in literature. It's awful difficult to do. And by the way, the researcher who publicly commented on the earlier study on a radio show was eventually sued by the author of the first study for slander and libel. And it took him a lot of money to extricate himself from the legal mess he got himself, because he only reported the truth. But he's an academician. He's not a journalist who has certain protections in making those kinds of reports. And to this day, he is still paying that second mortgage. And this has been about, I'd say, close to 8 years later. So you see, sometimes even though the truth is out there, you can't always depend on other researchers for helping you to find it. You have to go out there and search for it yourself, and hope that there's really good reviewers out there that will find it for you and bring it to your attention. So my advice to you is, if you get into any research at all that is slightly considered controversial, non-mainstream, not taught at medical school, not something that's a standard practice of your colleagues, I would highly advise you to make sure you know the literature. Because what always shocks me is when people call and they say, Alex, please help. I've got to go before my medical board on Wednesday. And I know you're really busy, but, you know, I need to know everything you got on such and such, which, you know, sometimes could involve boxes of material, which you can't even photocopy in time for the person to look at it. And then they got to read it, and they've got to summarize it, and their attorney has to look through it. So I'd never understand why clinicians ever get into anything that's different or new without reading the literature to begin with and convincing themselves that they're on fairly solid ground to begin with. And don't depend on us to do it. We make mistakes too. We miss articles. We make errors in our interpretation and translations that get us into a lot of trouble. The final thing I want to say, because I've got 1 minute left, is you probably see articles like this. This is from the San Jose Mercury News, March 22, 1994. The headline under the science scene is, Gene may make fat folks crave sweet goodies. Okay, this is this constant literature we see that genetics is responsible for everything. And I've been looking at this very carefully because of my interest in the behavioral sciences, and it's amazing how frequently I could just find two or three plausible alternative hypotheses in genetics, and how many times when the genetic theories are actually tested, they've been discounted. Now, I want to read something to you in a very short response to these kinds of articles that appeared in Time magazine on February 7th, 1994, as a letter to the editor. It says, not once did you mention the ability of nutritional factors to control gene expression. Our research, and that of others, shows that it is not the mere presence or absence of genes that determines disease, but also the ability of nutrition to control gene expression. The singular pursuit of molecular genetics is scientific arrogance gone wild. I thought it was very well put, and it was written by Professor T. Colin Campbell, who's the Jacob Gould Sherman Professor of Nutritional Biochemistry at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York. So I was quite impressed to see that. I've saved this for quite some time, but that's the Time magazine, page 7, February 7th, 1994. I know most of you are practicing the medicine of the future. You're going to be stabbed in the back an awful lot, you know. And unless you've got a tough hide, you got to get out of the business. Because we see, ultimately, regardless of all the studies we publish, all the double blind, all the arguments in the literature, what really is important in the end is the results you get with your patient. That, to me, is the most valid criteria for an outcome measure. Did your patient get well? We may have no ability to prove it scientifically, statistically, and we may have no reasonable explanation for the mechanism of action to explain the therapeutic benefits. But the fact that you get those results over and over and over again just forces us to challenge those out there in the scientific community to do research to find a way of explaining your results. Don't stop it. I know it's tough at times, but it's worth it. And just think of the satisfaction you get as you get older, knowing the good that you've done, and the peace that you will feel inside your spirit for having let your common sense prevail rather than oftentimes a lot of misleading science. With that, I want to thank you for joining me for the workshop. Thank you.